All right, welcome in everyone to the deep dive. We're going to tackle a case today that I think really cuts to the heart of so many election law debates, this idea of like, how do we balance the need for, you know, secure elections with making sure that everyone who is eligible can actually vote?
Yeah.
It's something you see popping up everywhere. In this case, we're diving into Northeast Ohio Coalition for the Homeless versus Blackwell, a 2006 case out of Ohio, really gives you a taste of how complicated this gets, you know?
I think that's right.
And, you know, the implications of this case are still being debated today. So let's bring in our expert here who can walk us through all the twists and turns of this one. So to set the stage, what was the initial event that kind of kicked off this whole legal battle?
Well, it started with a new law in Ohio, House Bill 3, passed in January of 2006.
Yeah.
And this bill introduced stricter photo ID requirements. But here's the catch. Only for absentee voting.
Oh, interesting. So right away, you can see how that might raise concerns, yeah. Right?
Absolutely. Because think about it. People who might have more difficulty getting traditional photo IDs, like, say, someone experiencing homelessness, they often rely on absentee voting.
Makes sense. And that brings us to who actually challenged this law, right?
Exactly. In October 2006, just a month before the election, the Northeast Ohio Coalition for the Homeless and the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, filed a lawsuit.
So they weren't just saying, oh, this is a little inconvenient. This is a full-blown legal challenge.
Oh, yeah. They were claiming that the law was unconstitutional under a very specific legal provision, 42 U.S.C. Section 1983.
Okay, so that means they believe this new law violated some pretty fundamental rights. What was the core of their argument, constitutionally speaking?
Well, they zeroed in on the 14th Amendment, particularly the Due Process and Equal Protection Clauses.
14th Amendment, that's a big one.
Huge. And their argument was twofold. First, they said the law was so vaguely written that voters couldn't understand what was even required of them. Like, what exactly constituted acceptable ID?
Yeah, I can see how that would be a problem.
Right, it wasn't clear cut. And their second point was that it led to unequal treatment of voters. Like, depending on when you voted and what kind of ID you had, you might be treated differently.
Let's dig a bit deeper into that vagueness issue. What specifically about the ID requirements was causing concern?
One of the big worries was that different county boards of elections might interpret the rules in different ways.
Oh, so even if you had an ID that, like, you thought was valid, you couldn't be sure it would be accepted everywhere.
Exactly. So imagine you're a voter without a driver's license, maybe you're homeless, and you have, say, a utility bill with your name and address. You're not sure if that's going to fly in every county.
Wow, that creates a real sense of uncertainty for voters. So how did the courts react initially?
Well, the district court actually sided with the plaintiffs at first. They granted a temporary restraining order on October 26, 2006.
So just days before the election.
Yeah, super close. And that meant that parts of House Bill 3 were basically put on hold because the court found them unconstitutionally vague.
Wow, a pretty significant initial victory for the plaintiffs, you would think.
Yeah, it seemed like they were gaining ground, but that win was extremely short-lived.
What happened?
The state appealed immediately to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And like 3 days later, on October 29th, the Sixth Circuit stayed the temporary restraining order.
Oh, so right back to square one, basically.
Pretty much. And you can see why the Sixth Circuit might have acted so fast. It was like crunch time with the election, and they were probably worried about throwing everything into chaos right before people went to vote.
Yeah, I guess that makes sense. So even though there was this temporary halt, ultimately the stricter ID rules were back in effect for that election.
Right, and it really shows how much weight courts give to not disrupting elections at the last minute. But here's the thing. Even though a consent order was approved on November 1st, 2006, trying to, like, clarify some of the ID rules, this whole legal fight dragged on for years.
Oh, wow, a decade-long legal battle. This thing had some legs.
Yeah, this wasn't a quick resolution. It was a long and winding road. And it shows just how contentious these voter ID laws can be.
Okay, so let's unpack those legal arguments a bit more. We talked about vagueness, but what other constitutional claims were the plaintiffs making?
Well, we've got the due process argument, which we touched on, basically saying the law was too unclear for voters to understand and follow.
Right.
Then there was the equal protection argument, saying this law was going to disproportionately affect certain groups, like homeless voters, minority voters, people who might have a harder time getting those photo IDs.
So an issue of fairness and equal access to the ballot box.
Exactly. And initially, they also brought a claim under the Voting Rights Act, arguing that this law was going to have a discriminatory effect on black voters specifically.
Okay, a lot of legal ground being covered here. But let's zoom in on the Sixth Circuit's decision, the one that put the brakes on that initial temporary restraining order. What was the logic behind that?
Well, they were using what's called the four-factor test to figure out if they should grant that stay. It's basically a balancing act the courts use when they're deciding on these, like, emergency requests for relief.
Four factors. Okay, let's break those down. What exactly is the court looking at?
So first, they look at how likely it is that the party asking for the stay, in this case the state, is going to win their appeal in the end.
So they're kind of predicting the future a little bit there.
In a way, yeah.
Yeah.
Then they look at whether the state would be irreparably harmed if the stay wasn't granted. Like, is there some damage that can't be undone?
Okay, so harm to the state. What's the third factor?
The flip side, what kind of harm would the plaintiffs, the ones who got the temporary restraining order, suffer if that order is put on hold?
Got it. So they're weighing the harm to both sides. What's the final piece of the puzzle?
The big picture. Where does the public interest lie? What's best for everyone involved?
That's a tough one to figure out sometimes, I'm sure.
Definitely. And in this case, the Sixth Circuit decided that Ohio's interest in having secure elections outweighed the plaintiff's arguments about potential harm, especially because it was all happening so close to Election Day.
I can imagine them thinking, you know, changing the rules right before people vote is going to be a mess.
Right. They were probably very concerned about creating confusion and maybe even undermining people's confidence in the election process. So maintaining the status quo, even with those challenged ID requirements, was seen as the less risky option in the short term.
Makes sense. Okay, so we've got this four-factor test, but I imagine there were some different opinions among the judges on the panel, right? Like, how to weigh those different factors.
Oh yeah, absolutely. In the majority opinion, written by Judge Gibbons, they were pretty skeptical about the plaintiff's chances of actually winning the whole case. They didn't think the plaintiffs had really shown that their members would be directly and immediately harmed by this new law. They also felt like the harm to the state, if the stay wasn't granted, you know, the possibility of election chaos, plus the public interest in making sure elections run smoothly, all of that tipped the scales in favor of the stay.
But they weren't completely heartless, right? Didn't they do something to try and protect the plaintiff's case down the line?
Yeah, they did. They added a requirement that the state had to hold on to all the absentee ballots just in case the lower court's ruling eventually got reinstated. So, like, a little safety net for the plaintiffs there.
Okay, a little bit of a compromise. That's the majority.
Yeah.
What did the dissent have to say?
Judge Tarnow wrote the dissent, and he really thought the Sixth Circuit should have given more weight to what the district court had found. Remember, the district court had heard all the initial evidence and thought that the voter ID law was likely to cause a lot of confusion.
Yeah, that was their reasoning for the temporary restraining order in the first place.
Exactly. So Judge Tarnow felt like the Sixth Circuit was, you know, overstepping a bit by second-guessing the district court's assessment of the situation.
So a difference of opinion on how much deference to give to that initial ruling makes sense. Now, you mentioned the Voting Rights Act earlier. What ultimately happened with that part of the case?
That's interesting because it actually popped up again later in the case. Not with House Bill 3 directly, but with some other Ohio election laws, Senate Bills 205 and 216. In 2016, the district court found that parts of those bills violated the Voting Rights Act.
Oh, wow. So even though the initial challenge didn't get far with that argument, it came back around later.
Exactly. And this time, the district court agreed that certain provisions, like, you know, requiring complete and accurate info on provisional ballots, limiting the help poll workers could give, and shortening the time to fix problems with provisional ballots, all of those, the court said, had a discriminatory effect on black voters.
So they were seeing a pattern of laws that, even if they didn't explicitly target black voters, ended up having a negative impact on them.
Right. It's that idea of disparate impact, where a seemingly neutral law ends up affecting certain groups more harshly. But of course, this is the legal system, so it didn't end there, right?
Well, I'm sure there's another twist coming.
You bet. The state appealed that ruling, too. And this time, the Sixth Circuit reversed the district court. They said Ohio had a really strong interest in preventing voter fraud, so those stricter rules were justified.
So again, that balancing act, right? Preventing fraud versus making sure everyone can vote.
Yeah, and which way the scales tip can really depend on the specific facts of the case and the arguments made. This case really highlights that ongoing struggle in election law.
Absolutely. And you mentioned earlier there was also a concurring opinion in the initial Sixth Circuit ruling. What was that about?
Yeah, Judge McKeague agreed with the majority's decision to stay the restraining order, but he raised a concern about something called associational standing.
Okay, that sounds kind of technical. What's that all about?
Basically, it's the idea that organizations like the Northeast Ohio Coalition for the Homeless can bring lawsuits on behalf of their members without naming specific individuals who've been harmed.
So they're representing a group of people who share a common concern.
Right. But Judge McKee was a little worried about making it too easy for groups to sue, even if they couldn't point to concrete harm to specific people. He thought it could potentially open the floodgates to lawsuits that might not be, as strong or as necessary.
Interesting. So he was raising a caution flag about like the broader implications for the legal system.
Yeah, he was thinking about the big picture and potential unintended consequences.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground with this case. When we step back and look at NEOCH versus Blackwell, why does this 2006 case still matter today for understanding election law?
Well, I think one of the big takeaways is that it shows just how hard it is to prove discriminatory intent under the 14th Amendment. The plaintiffs were arguing that this law was intentionally designed to harm certain groups, but they didn't really convince the courts.
So even if a law has a disparate impact, it doesn't necessarily mean it was discriminatory from the get-go.
Right, and that's a tough standard to meet. But on the other hand, the case also shows how the Voting Rights Act can be a powerful tool, especially when you're focusing on the effects of a law, not just the intent.
So like with those later rulings on the Senate bills where the court said, look, regardless of the intention, these rules are actually making it harder for Black voters to participate.
Exactly, and that's a reminder that both arguments, intent, and effect are important in this area of law.
Yeah, it's complicated. And this whole case just highlights how, every election law is trying to walk this tightrope between protecting the integrity of the election and making sure everyone can vote.
Absolutely. And it's not an easy balance to strike. I mean, Ohio, for example, they've actually made their election rules even stricter in some ways since this case, especially after those later rulings on Senate Bills 205 and 216.
So this debate is still very much alive, how to find that sweet spot between security and access.
Oh, yeah, it's constant back and forth. And that's what makes cases like NECH versus Blackwell so relevant. They give us a glimpse into how those arguments play out in real life, and they remind us that these issues aren't going away anytime soon.
And for anyone studying law, I think this case is like a master class in how those procedural details, the restraining orders, the appeals, even who has standing to sue, all of that really shapes the outcome of a case.
For sure. All those procedural steps and rules, they're not just technicalities, they have real impact on how the law is applied and who gets to have their voice heard in court.
Yeah, it's a good reminder that procedure matters. So as we wrap up this deep dive, what would you say are the most important things to remember about Northeast Ohio Coalition for the Homeless versus Blackwell?
I think there are a few key points. First, it shows the tension between election security and voter access. That's a theme that runs through so much of election law. Second, it highlights how important it is for voter ID laws to be crystal clear so people understand what they need to do and there's no room for different interpretations.
Clarity is key.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Third, it's a great example of how courts use that four-factor test to make decisions in these emergency situations right before an election. And lastly, it reminds us that these voting rights cases often involve complex procedural battles that can drag on for years.
Wow, a lot to unpack there. And it makes you wonder, when courts are looking at these laws that could affect certain communities more than others, what should they be prioritizing? How do we make sure we're protecting both the integrity of the election and the right to vote for everyone, especially those who might face more barriers?
Yeah. Tough questions, and there's no easy answer. But I think those are the questions we need to keep asking ourselves as we grapple with these issues.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for walking us through all of this. It's been really illuminating.
My pleasure. Glad we could dive into it.
And to everyone listening, thanks for joining us on the deep dive. Keep those brains working, and we'll catch you next time.